The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Weekly Connect. I'm Stephen Scott with you once again for another week. And as it's almost Valentine's Day, we get all mushy this week and talk about love. But is love at first sight something that is possible when you have no sight? Well, our panel weigh in. Also, would you like to join other blind and partially sighted people to learn and play music? Well, we meet blind musician Nikki Kelly to find out more about her new project. And there's a new group for blind and partially sighted people set up by one of us. It's all about connecting, yeah. It's in Chorley in Lancashire. And later, our community reporter Danielle will be here with more on that. That's all to come on this week's The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect. The Weekly Connect. On RNIB Connect Radio.
But yeah, first this week, we are going to be talking about relationships and finding love with our panel this week. So who's on the line?
I'm Liz Franklin. I live near Doncaster. I'm actually one of the RNIB connectors for Yorkshire and Humber, and I have a guide dog called Ebony.
I'm Chris Reddington. I am an ECLO for Rhondacum and Taff in South Wales. I sort of just started that role.
Hi, I'm Diane Woodford. I'm also a guide dog owner, also from the Yorkshire area, so you've got two Yorkshire girls, and my guide dog, Stacey, and I work for the customer council on the RNIB.
Fantastic. Well, guys, good to have you here. And we're talking about relationships this week because it's Valentine's week. Liz, I'm going to start with you on this one. How romantic a person are you?
Oh, dear. I never thought I was particularly romantic at all until I actually met Paul, who I'm with now. And I buy him ridiculously sloppy Valentine's cards and things, which is something I never did before. So I think there might have been a latent romantic me for many, many years, but it only came out in the last 3.5 years while I've been with Paul.
Oh, how nice. How nice. Tell me this. How do you buy Valentine's cards? Because I can never read what's in them.
Well, I can't read them either because I have no useful sight at all. So, fortunately, living in a community where everybody knows me, it's quite easy to just go into the local card shop and say, well, I'd like a card for such and such a body. And they usually know who it is who I'm actually getting the card for, so they'll say, well, I don't think that'll suit Paul. No, this one would be better. So they read the captions and they describe the pictures, and to a certain extent they help me make the choice. So it's actually quite a good way to do it. If people know who you are, it makes life a lot easier.
Okay, Chris, are you a big romantic?
I don't know. It depends who you speak to.
Oh, that's that's a leading answer.
Some people say I am. Some people say I'm not. I guess in some ways yes. In some ways maybe no. I'm a bit innocent, I suppose.
Okay.
But
what about you, Diane?
I am over the top cheesy romantic. I'm a Jane Austen, Mr. Darcy lady.
Oh no, really?
So, romantically hopeless.
Well, just to give you an indication of what I'm like, my wife and I both said to each other last year on February 13th, did you buy me a card, dear? And my wife said no. And she said, did you buy me one? I said no. She went, that's fine, let's just leave it. So that gives you an idea.
That's marriage for you.
That's marriage for you, exactly. Okay, so we want to talk about relationships, and I guess we want to talk a little bit about getting into relationships. It's a big topic for a lot of people, and it's something I know everyone has wanted to talk about in the programme for a long time. You know, Liz, I'll come to you first on this one. You know, what is it like trying to meet someone when you've got no vision at all? You know, they say that, you know, it's love at first sight, but how do you achieve that without sight?
That's quite an interesting one. So I've had several relationships that have kind of burned themselves out and come to nothing, but I've not actually had much difficulty meeting somebody. And I think that's simply because if you are out and about, in, you know, getting into the community and meeting people, you will meet somebody. So I have had a number of relationships through meeting people through fundraising for guide dogs, for instance, or through courses I've taken. But the partner I'm with now, Paul, I actually met him through internet dating.
Oh,
and
right.
The reason why I went down that route was because nothing else had worked. I'd never managed to sustain a relationship for long with anybody else. And I had a sighted friend who was wanting to meet somebody as well. So we decided we would sign up for internet dating together and see how we got on. And we chose the Telegraph dating site, not particularly because of the politics, but because you had to pay to be on this site. And we felt that that was a better bet, because if people were serious enough to pay money up to be on a dating site, they were seriously looking to meet somebody. And we signed up for 6 months, and the friends never really got anywhere either. But I must admit, I found it was really quite a disheartening experience in a lot of ways, because the idea was that you sent out emails to people you liked the look of. You would read the profiles on the internet, and you could email these people. And I sent email after email after email to all these men. And a lot of them never even actually replied. And if they did reply, they might actually probably communicate a couple of times and then they'd just disappear. If it lasted slightly longer than that, I found that if you finally sort of suggested that you might meet, they would definitely disappear then. And then it was just soul destroying, to be honest. I did wonder was because I had the dilemma of, do I actually point out that I can't see? And what I actually did on my profile was put it ambiguously. I did actually say I'd got a guide dog, but I didn't actually say I am totally blind. I can't remember how I phrased it, but I actually said something along the lines of that I had sight issues, which could have been anything from partial sight to complete blindness, and it was a bit ambiguous. So the person reading the profile wouldn't be really sure, but I couldn't help wondering if that might have been part of the reason why I had a lack of response. But equally, I thought, I can't really land them on the day that they agree to meet me with saying, oh, by the way, I can't see. So It was a tough one, and I did figure that it was still better to actually put it on the profile, at least, even if it was ambiguously. Mm. Anyway, in the end, I finally got a reply back from somebody, and I'd sent out so many emails to people that when I actually got this email, I couldn't even remember who this guy was. And I had to look at his profile again to remind me who he was. And I thought, oh, yes, I do remember him now. And he actually persisted in emailing me, and we did actually email each other for about a month, and I didn't actually suggest that we met because I thought, oh, that'll be the way he'll disappear, and I'm quite enjoying this communication with this man. But he in the end actually suggested that we met, and I then said okay then, and I suggested a restaurant that we could meet at. But unfortunately, what I hadn't realised was that the restaurant I'd suggested was a self-service one, because it was somewhere I hadn't been before. And Paul, who is now my partner of 3.5 years, said that he then panicked and thought, oh no, what do I do? I've got to do a self-service restaurant with a totally blind person, because by this time I had admitted that I couldn't see at all. And I did give him the option at the time. I said, well, you know, if you'd rather do something else and we can go somewhere else, I don't mind. But he did say that if he hadn't actually attempted to do that, he might have spent the rest of his life wondering if he could have managed. And he did actually manage very well. And I went into this date with not a deal of optimism, because I thought, well, it's not been much success so far. What's this going to be like? And actually, the day flew by. We had a wonderful time. And the only reason I had to come home was because I had to feed the dog. And I had no provision for the guide dog with me. So I had to go home and say, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to break this up because I've got to go home and feed my dog. And but then we did make a date to meet again. And the rest, as they say, is history. And so we have been together now 3.5 years.
That's a great story. Really, really good story. And I think it shows that, you know, there are options out there for you. You know, if you are on your own and you're maybe wanting company, then, you know, internet dating, give it a try. You found it reasonably accessible, yeah? You didn't have any issues with that?
The one big issue I had was at the beginning when I had to pay. There was a page that was quite easy to follow to actually put in your card details and the details that were required to actually pay up. However, the one problem with it was that there were like little icons to show you which credit cards there were, and it just said with my speech reader was icon, 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 and I had no idea which was mine. So the friend who I was actually doing the internet dating with, I had to ring her in Croydon, because that's where she lived, and say, Jane, will you actually pull up this page and tell me which one is, and I gave her my credit card, which kind of credit card I was using. And she had to sort of go through the page and then say, well, it's the third one down. And I had to then press on the third one down and hope that I'd actually got the right icon. So that was a bit of an issue. But apart from that, the profiles were very easy, and there were like little combo boxes to describe yourself, and they were quite easy to use. I actually found the Telegraph dating site actually very easy to use, and I'm not a very computer literate person.
Okay. Well, you know, really interesting to hear your story. We've still got Diane and Chris with us, who will be telling their story in just a little while here on The Weekly Connect. Thanks, Liz.
The Weekly Connect. The Weekly Connect. On RNIB Connect Radio.
Let's follow up now on last week's story about the state of the UK's roads. Lots of you have been in touch. The most common complaints we heard about last week on our panel were around A-boards, parked cars, and in general a poor state of the pavements themselves, leading to, in some cases, injuries caused by falling or tripping. Let's talk some more about the issues that are affecting you directly. In fact, let's go to the phones. Who's there?
Oh, hello. I'm Carol Holmes in Blackpool, and I'm a guide dog owner. And up until 5 years ago, I could walk about safely. Blackpool has lovely wide pavements, and it was a joy. But over the last 5 years, I am really struggling, and other guide dog owners in Blackpool, but I believe it is, you know, a problem nationally as well. Cars, for some unknown reason, have decided it's their right to park high on the pavements. There was a time when they could park just with two wheels on the pavement. Now they park two-thirds of the car on the pavement. And during the spring and summer and autumn, quite often, the overhanging bushes, and there's more and more of them, my solution was that my daughter dropped letters through their letterbox just to make them aware that if I was going along a pavement, the actual bushes were meeting the cars. So, of course, my dog is trained, if he sees it as an obstacle, to guide me to the curb, walk into the road, walk round the car, rejoin the pavement and follow on our route. But I actually don't like walking in the road these days because the traffic is so speedy. Seems a lot quicker. And also it's quieter. I can't hear them the same, the motors. The other thing is that cars, they don't have the flexible wing mirrors now. They're solid. And I'm forever having bruises on my forearm. And if it's a big vehicle, luckily it's only happened to me once, I got the most awful bruise on my top of my arm. In fact, my daughter took a picture of it and we sent it to the council. Because those big vehicles, their wing mirrors are solid, but they're also on an arm. I actually was just grateful it wasn't my head. The other thing is, they will park on the corners. So your dog can't find a corner to cross, and you find your dog is crossing diagonally, and which actually can be very disorientating. Doesn't take much to disorientate me. I've also had the problem of twice now, cars reversing out of their driveways, and because there's a busy road nearby and I've got the noise of all the cars, I didn't hear them, and, well, both of them hit me, but they didn't hurt me because my dog had pulled me. And both of them, when I stopped, banged on the car, said they didn't see me. Now, that really alarmed me. I mean, aren't you meant to check the pavement before you reverse out of your driveway? I thought you were. And then the other thing is, the cars, some cars, they drive up on the pavement in front of you and open their door. My poor dog's been hit on the head with the door. Anyway, in Blackpool, I must say, the Highways Committee are listening to me and I've got a meeting with them on Wednesday. What I'm hoping for with my meeting is that at long last, the council will realise that the first 4 foot of the pavement from the wall should be for pedestrians. And I've not even mentioned the bins, but we won't go there. But definitely that's what I'm hoping for, and eventually for a street charter for Blackpool, which the RNIB campaign lady is going to help me with.
Okay, thanks, Carol. Well, if you have a comment that you would like to make on either the state of the UK's roads or indeed any issue that you've heard here on the programme, then please do get in touch. You can email us, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. And thank you to those of you who've been in touch this week already. We are getting back to a lot of you because a lot of you want to come on and talk on the programme more than just email, which is fantastic. So if you do want to add your voice to the show, it is your show. We are literally handing the mic to you. What do you want to say on the mic? Well, you can get in touch with theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. That's the email address. Or on Twitter, if you so wish. It's a very popular medium these days, made popular by one particular man who happens to be the President of the United States. Yeah, I knew you got where I was going with that one. But yeah, please do get in touch on Twitter. You can do that at RNIB Radio, and you can use the hashtag TheWeeklyConnect. Now, it is nearly Valentine's Day, and if music is the food of love, play on, someone famous once said. I think it was Shakespeare, wasn't it? Well, that's certainly the idea behind the VIP project, which is being run by musician, blind musician, Nikki Kelly. And the great news is it's open to you as well. Listen out for more details on that in a moment. But first, let's hear from Sophia Asif, who has spoken to Nikki this week to find out more about the project.
You say that I'm not good enough. You claim that I won't go far. Well, I say that I'll never give up. Nothing you can do can keep me down, down. I'll show you what I'm made of. I'll show you.
So, Nikki, thanks very much for joining us on the Weekly Connect today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Would you like to just tell our listeners a little bit about your VIP workshop, which is based in Birmingham?
Yes, that's right. The VIP workshop and project is a series of songwriting and performance workshops delivered by singer-songwriters that are successful and established in the industry today. And it's for visually impaired people aged 18 to 35.
So tell us a little bit about how this came about and then the process that you went through in order to set it up.
So in terms of the sight loss, I was 22 and going through a really deep depression, and I was always passionate about music, and, you know, I was just listening to music as I did every day. When I was feeling really, really depressed one day, I was playing some music and this song came on that really affected me at that moment. And more or less straight away, I decided to write down how I felt. And when I wrote that down, I found that was quite relieving of the feelings that I had. And so after that, I just kept writing poems, and the poems would evolve into songs. And then I couldn't play an instrument at that point. So then, as I wanted to be able to do everything, I decided to start learning to play the piano and keyboard. And then eventually they became songs, and yeah, I'm now a singer-songwriter.
And do you perform yourself?
Yes, yeah, I perform at quite a few open mics in Birmingham and in London, and I accompany myself either on piano or guitar.
And how did you meet and start working with the other contributors to these workshops?
I'm actually a massive fan of Fiona's music, and I discovered her music back in 2014, and for lack of a better description, I quietly stalked her. she was really lovely and we got on, and I told her about my idea for the project and asked if she wanted to be on board, and she was like, yeah, definitely. And so she's now part of that. And as for Dan, I've known him for a good few years, and he used to run, well, he still does, run a songwriting circle for all, basically. And I went to that, and through that, me and Dan became really good friends. And yeah, and so that's how I got him on board. And again, Michael Clark, we've been really good friends. We've done a lot of music work together in terms of music production and some co-writing for artists together. And so, yeah, he was on board as well.
When did the idea of running this workshop come to you?
I was at a R&IB event, and there was this one particular woman who didn't work for R&IB, but she was saying that there's a lot of children that she works with who are like teenagers, and they want to pursue music but feel so isolated, and they end up getting depressed and going through the mental health service. And I just can't sit here and not try to help. So initially I've done this project to start from for 18-year-olds, and if it's successful, we want to go for younger audiences as well. As I applied through Arts Council, you literally have to put forward a budget and say what every single penny is going to be on. They want to know the venues, everything. So it took 6 or 9 months to get the whole thing together, get it submitted, and also get the funding and the agreement from Arts Council. So it's been a very long process, but it really feels worth it.
So when you were applying with the Arts Council, did you find that they were easy to work with?
Yeah, the Arts Council were absolutely brilliant. They were so, so supportive. Like at the stage where I decided I'm going to put in an application to Arts Council, I phoned them up and they informed me that I can have a support worker during the application process, and even if I'm not going to be successful. So I was able to have a support worker help me fill in the form, because they have an online portal that's quite difficult to use. And you know, if I had any questions or if my support worker had any questions, they were so giving with their time and explanations. They were brilliant. I can't fault them. And obviously I love them even more because they gave me the grant. So,
well, I mean, they must have been impressed with the proposal that you'd put together. They must have felt that it was meeting a need within the community in order to be able to fund it. So you have how many places available?
We have 8. All you have to be is 18 to 35 and be visually impaired and be passionate about music. You don't have to play an instrument. You don't need to be able to sing. You know, this isn't a course on how to write a hit or how to be a singer-songwriter. It's just about getting that creativity out of people and giving them the forum to express it and perform it. You know, you don't have to be a seasoned professional. You can be an absolute beginner.
So people who apply for these workshops will get an opportunity to perform?
Yes, they will. So we'll select 8 successful applicants, and on the 10th of May, we will have a live gig at a place called MAC in Birmingham, which is the Midlands Arts Centre. And the artists will perform, so it'll be myself, Dan, Michael and Fiona, and also all the participants will perform an original song as well. And if they don't feel comfortable performing, they can either play a recording, and if they can't play an instrument, one of us or all of us will play for them so that they can sing or do whatever they're for, and even if it's just a musical piece.
So there'll be an element of performance then for the candidates who are successful?
Yes, yes. There'll be a performance in the main theatre, which I'm really, really excited about. Me, Dan, Michael or Fiona will also accompany them if that's what they want. We'll do whatever we can for them to ensure that they play one of their songs in some capacity on that night.
Nikki, it sounds like such a fantastic initiative. Well done for getting it off the ground. It must have been an amazing sense of achievement just to even get this far.
Thank you. Yeah, it does really feel like one sometimes. Sometimes we're like, you know, get a little bit nervous. And also, as Fiona is one of my favourite artists, and it's really going to be the first time she's really seen me perform on that night. So it feels like the stakes are really high for many reasons. And I just really want the participants to get so much out of it and enjoy it and just be creative and enjoy the experience.
Best of luck with all of it. I'm sure it will be a fantastic night and certainly memorable for everybody who's going to be involved in it. Thanks so much for coming onto the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Go, I'll show you what I'm made of.
Well, if you'd like to show them what you're made of, then go to the VIP Project website. The website address is allthews.theviproject.com. The dates for applying and the workshop are on the website. Also, it's good to know they're offering some help towards travelling costs, and the details for all of the artists who are supporting this are also on the website. That address again is theviproject.com. Now, coming up on the Weekly Connect, we hear more stories of getting into relationships with our panel, as it's almost Valentine's Day. We thought we'd talk about love, and dating is a topic that I know you are very keen to talk about. And we meet another connector. This time we meet someone who decided to set up a group for other blind and partially sighted people in her area in Lancashire. Oh, and if you fancy a game of golf, we have a society for that. Stay tuned.
Happy 100th birthday to RNIB's oldest magazine. NB Online provides news, views, research and developments aimed at professionals in the eye health and sight loss sectors. When NB Online's first edition was published in 1917, Britain and France were fighting against Germany in World War I and revolution had broken out in Russia. Times have changed, but for 100 years, NB has been a vital source of information and an influential forum to discuss the key issues that affect you. And now you can join over 3,000 professionals, local society staff and support groups who are already receiving MB Online Magazine's fortnightly e-newsletter. To find out more and to read MB Online Magazine during their anniversary year, you can go to the website www.rnib.org.uk/NB-online. And you can help us celebrate MB's 100th birthday by sharing your stories and feedback with us. Call 020 7391 2073 or email mbonline@rnib.org.uk.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Do you get stuck when it comes to technology? Don't worry, help is at hand with RNIB's Technology Support Squad. We can give you advice over the phone or visit you at home to help you master your technology. Help is at hand, from setting up a mobile phone and getting the most out of it to using the accessibility features on your PC. Or maybe you need help with your Daisy talking book player. You can email technologysquad@rnib.org.uk and we'll get right back to you. Or call our helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. Get the most out of your technology with RNIB's Technology Support Squad.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
So earlier we were talking to Liz Franklin about dating, and you know, she told us an amazing story about her experience of getting out there and actually trying it with internet dating, and obviously very successful. Still with us on the line, Diane Woodford and Chris Reddington from earlier. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hiya.
Chris, let me come to you then. So, you know, you heard Liz's story, internet dating, really worked for her. She sounds quite confident about the whole thing. What about you? What's your experience of dating and relationships?
Well, I guess it started when I was sort of in a similar way to most people, when I was at school and stuff, and you had the sort of the very young relationships, and over time that developed into sort of more serious relationships as I grew up, and I had a very long relationship that lasted for a couple of years, and that kind of ended quite suddenly, and then I sort of thought, right, I don't know what to do from here. I don't really know what to do. And so I went away at that time on a big lottery-funded Action residential, just to see what was going on, not even considering dating or anything for a while. Yeah, I'd sort of had enough. So I went away on this big lottery event to the Windermere Manor in the Lake District, and got talking to a few people and met some really lovely people. One of the people I met was a little dog that kept coming to me under the table and nudging me and coming for fuss and wagging its tail and going back somewhere. and I hadn't realised where. And it was a very, very funny thing because I hadn't quite figured out who this dog belonged to. And I was trying to do a little bit of detective work. Oh, did you know your dog? Did you know your dog was coming to visit me at dinner time and things? So there was that. And on the last day, I worked it out. I worked out the puzzle that it belonged to a lady called Andrea. And I didn't really have a lot of time to speak to Andrea at all. I just said, oh, I've been fussing your dog. And that was basically it. And we had mutual friends, and we hadn't really spoken very much, but we sort of swapped details and everything, because there was a whole group of us who wanted to go away again. We'd got on so well that we all wanted to go away again. And so about 4 or 5 months later, we went away to the other Vision Hotel in Devon, the Cliff Den. And whilst there, we got talking, me and Andrea. And at this point still, I really hadn't considered dating at all. And me and Edie, the guide dog, got on very well. We were talking and fussing, and I was talking to Andrea at the same time, on the beach and things. And it just so happened that we were walking back from the beach and there was a step. And just out of instinct, I grabbed Andrea by the hand and I said, oh, watch out. There's a step there, and I just pulled her out of the way very gently by her hand. And it was at that moment that I thought, hang on a minute, there's something a little more special here than meets the eye. And so from that on, that moment on, we were kind of inseparable, really. And we got talking, and when we went home, we sort of spoke over the phone and everything. And yeah, eventually we decided that we would try a relationship, and we did the whole long distance relationship thing for about 18 months, which is very difficult, because obviously there's a lot of strain because you're only speaking to each other for weeks on end. You have to travel for hours on end to see each other. I was in Norwich and she was in Manchester, and so it was a long way. But we did it really well. We took things very gently. We spent time together, really important time together, and we made some very special places. We went down to Devon, we investigated Edinburgh, we investigated Manchester and Norwich, and we really explored together, and that allowed us to really develop our relationship into something that is really beautiful and really special. And so that now when we are living together in Cardiff, of all places, we still enjoy exploring and still enjoy trying new things. And that really gives the relationship so much spice and so much empowerment, because it pushes you to do new and interesting things. And I really don't think that I would be where I am today without that relationship, because it's almost like having your lover, your best friend, and your soulmate all in one big package. And it's amazing.
Oh, Chris, I'm welling up here. That's a lovely story. I can see the movie now, from Manchester to Norwich. It's a love story. It's waiting to happen. I guess Richard Gere will be in it. Oh, it'll be incredible. Chris, that's a lovely story, and thank you for sharing it. Diane, are you as romantic as Chris? You say you're cheesy with your...
I am very cheesy romantic. I'm nearly crying at his story.
I know.
It's so amazing. My story is slightly different. When I lost my sight suddenly at 38, I was a single mum. And, you know, I wanted to meet somebody special. So, strangely, I found it really strange going from being a sighted person and being able to get eye contact with people in pubs or groups or whatever I was doing, to suddenly not being able to get that eye contact was quite hard. So you can't sort of smile or anything at somebody. You don't know somebody's watching you. So I decided to do the internet dating. Mine was probably not quite as good of an experience, but I really, really quite enjoyed some of the experiences of meeting people. And, you know, I was newly VI. I didn't actually put on my profile that I was visually impaired, because I felt it made me a bit vulnerable and I didn't want people to think they could take advantage of me because I couldn't see. And it wasn't until I got speaking to people, then I would mention, oh, well, actually, you know, if we get email, it started email, yeah, I am visually impaired. Occasionally that would stop people, like, sorry, you're not for me. And so that was quite disheartening and very much like, well, why I'm no different than I was a few years ago when I could see. But I think one of my famous stories, I had a guide dog called Hattie at the time, and my story was this guy was very, very nicely talking to me, emailing me. His profile was wonderful. And I told him I couldn't see, and in fact, he seemed really happy about it. And I was like, oh, okay, that's okay. My friend said, oh, you know, he looks quite young. The photo looks good. I couldn't see the photo. I eventually turned up on our first date, and I had Hattie with me. And the reason I think he was really, really happy was because his photo was probably about 20 years old. He was a lot older than the photograph. So when I first met him, he, you know, I could hear his false teeth moving. And, you know, he generally sort of was not what I expected. And but courteously, I sat and ate the meal with him. And we went and sat in a more comfortable area in the restaurant to have a glass of wine. And I'm thinking, oh, you know, how long do I have to stay to be polite, not to upset him? At which point, he leant forward and his toupee fell off.
Oh, no.
But the dog thought it was some sort of rabbit. She was newly qualified guide dog. She went, oh, this is fun. She's raking it around and shaking it all over. So I just sort of prized it out the dog's mouth and thought, I think this belongs to you.
Here's your toupee back. Sorry for the
toupee back. So, yes, he was a lot older. Certainly, you know, interesting. So it is interesting doing the whole blind dating with people, you know, you've met on the internet. So the only good thing is you don't have to sit and wear a rose because they know who you are, because you're the only one sat there with a guide dog waiting for them. So, oh, you'll easy notice me. I'll have the guide dog with me.
But it does seem that, you know, from all of the experiences we've heard this week, that, you know, it's just about getting out there, isn't it?
Yeah. It is very, you are very vulnerable, and I think for a lady, you are vulnerable because, you know, you're sort of trusting whoever you're meeting. But I met people who I'm still friends with now. It never particularly worked out as a date. There was not particularly the chemistry there, but, you know, I've got some really good friends I've met along the way. So.
And what about you, Chris? Do you ever feel like that? I mean, you know, is it a woman thing? Do guys feel vulnerable when you're out dating, in your case?
I think there was some of that, particularly sort of very early on when I was just starting. I think I did feel like, what if I've misinterpreted something? What if I've misunderstood something? And so I think at times I was extra careful. And I could make things awkward by sort of doing that. But I always, because of the way I'd always try and explain it. And I think because the nature of my humour is sort of quite self-deprecating, I could kind of get away with that. But I mean, when I remember going on a date, and the girl I was with, she got up and left. And I thought,
no way.
Oh God, has she just left me sort of standing here? And as it turned out, she hadn't. She'd gone and bought something for herself or something. But you do have those panicky moments
because you don't know. You don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. And whereas a sighted person might be able to look round and see that she was at the bar or something, you know, you can't necessarily do that. I think though, it is, as you say, it's a case of getting out there. And I think if you do make the whole vision thing awkward, it makes it a lot harder. But with me, I'm sort of very open. It's a sort of very obvious thing. And I think quite a lot of the time, if you do have that sort of mutual attraction, sometimes it can be a point of interest, which sounds quite bizarre, but sometimes it's a way of people getting talking.
And I think as well, it's interesting because I often hear people say, you know, it's funny, I'm kind of in this bracket myself. You know, you hear a lot of blind and partially sighted people, you know, who've got partners who are also blind or partially sighted. And that's not uncommon because, you know, Chris, as you've said, you know, oftentimes you will meet people who are in your community, if you like. And that's the case with me and my wife. But, you know, it's interesting when you go into the world of internet dating, as Diane and Liz earlier did, you know, you are going to meet people who are sighted. I mean, you might meet someone who's blind. That would be interesting. But actually, you know, you're probably more likely to meet someone who's fully sighted. And actually, you're probably going a little bit against the grain there, Diane.
Yeah, I mean, my one of my successes on internet dating, actually, once I said I couldn't see, Googled how to talk to a blind person.
Wow.
Because they'd never, ever done it before. So they were like, let's
help them out now, Diane. Let's help them out now. The answer is, like a human being. Try that.
Yeah, but, you know, it is like, I think it probably is scary for other people. How do you approach somebody with sight loss? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point because actually it's twofold, isn't it? You know, we talk about this from the point of view of ourselves, you know, having to go out there into the world and meet people. You know, going to a bar, for example, could be awkward because, you know, you don't know who's standing next to you, you don't know who you're talking to, if you can hear them. But, you know, actually there's a difficulty on the other side because someone might meet someone. And, you know, there are probably countless stories of this where, you know, a guy's sitting at a bar looking at a woman. He knows she's blind, but he thinks she's incredibly attractive, wants to talk to her, but just doesn't know how to approach. It's a two-way street. And we probably don't think about it like that.
Yeah, and I think for me, I really did have a sort of a head start because going to sort of a mainstream school and when you're getting to that first sort of dating age, by the time I'd reached about sort of 14, 15, 16, my peers knew that I was sort of a normal human being. And they knew that, like, I wasn't going to grow a tentacle or anything if they spoke to me. And so this made sort of dating with my sort of peers in my class and whatever a lot easier because they just saw me as another member of the class. They didn't even see it, a visual impairment. And so I like having dated sighted peers in that respect, it was a lot easier for them, I think, because they knew me beforehand.
Yeah.
And I think sort of on that experience, I did tend to get to know people, particularly sighted people, before I went out with them.
Yeah.
And just so that it gave them a chance to get to know me and obviously me a chance to get to know them. And you'd sort of follow that pathway, as it were.
Well, it's been a really interesting conversation. We could talk about it for days, I'm sure, because there are so many different aspects to this. But what I really hope people get from this, sighted people and partially sighted people included, you know, it's a case of getting out there. It's a case of just trying to shake off the lack of confidence that we all have. And that is aimed at both sighted and blind and partially sighted people. Because, you know, if you meet someone or you see someone and you think, actually, I find them very attractive, but because they're blind, I don't know how to approach them. Just approach them, because they're human beings like you and I. We're all human beings.
I think most blind people have got quite a good sense of humour.
Probably more than some sighted people.
Yeah.
Because
I think it's funny when you start talking about blind jerks. They're like, oh, you can't talk about that.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's great. And I think we absolutely want to make people think like that, because, you know, there's no barrier between us. There is no barrier apart from the ones we put up ourselves. That's what I think. Diane Woodford and Chris Reddington, really good to talk to you. Thank you for joining us here on The Weekly Connect.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you.
And if you want to add your voice to The Weekly Connect at any time, you can do so. theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk is our email address. Now, on our Meet the Connectors this week, we find out about what one of our connectors have been up to in their local area. Let's find out more as we join our community reporter, Daniel Colcombe.
Hi everyone, this is Danielle Colcombe. I'm a community facilitator in the Northwest and I'm here with Lynn today. Now Lynn is one of our very active volunteers in Chorley and she's here to tell us about her new group, which is called Sightseekers, which is very exciting peer support. So Lynn, can you tell me how the group started?
Yeah, we started
as a group of people who'd been on the Living with Sight Loss courses that the RNIB Action Group offered, and we all found that we wanted to stay in touch with each other. So what basically happened, from probably two or three people on the first Living with Sight Loss course, every time there was a Living with Sight Loss course, more people would said, hey, we want to get involved with this. So we now meet once a month on the last Wednesday in Chorley, and we have about 56 members now, and we're sight seekers, but we're not a group, we're a family.
Oh, that is really inspiring. And you know what I love most about that is how you said that you're a family. So can you tell me what the group kind of offers and what you all get out of it?
The main thing about the group is it's getting together a group of people who emotionally can share their feelings with each other. But also, it's really kind of like-minded people coming together, really, to, well, have fun. It's not really a stuffy group. Like I said, I don't like to refer to it as a group because it's not. It's a family. We hug each other. We share things, like if somebody wants to talk about the grandchildren, we talk about the grandchildren. If somebody wants to come into the group and talk about what's happening at the local library, for instance, or what local services are being offered in the area, then we have people coming into the group also. But it's mainly a get-together for people who emotionally are all on the same wavelength, but to help people in varying degrees of sight loss, really.
I notice you keep coming back to this element of emotional support, mm-hmm. and I'm a particular fan of peer support and how that can benefit mm-hmm. people. Have you noticed any changes with anyone in the group since they've... the family,
yeah.
since they've started attending?
Me.
Yeah. tell me about you.
Well, when I was first asked to facilitate the group, I thought, what can I offer? What do I know? I hadn't worked for many years because of my eyesight and was really, believe it or not, I know I might sound chatty, but I lacked self-confidence. My confidence had gone, my ability in what I could do. So I found that one of the big changes is me. I feel like I've been brought back to life so I can help people to do this. But the group also helped me. They help me to function and make me feel good about myself, that I can contribute to the community.
That's incredible. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts for the future. Where can this go? Where can peer support go? And where can sight seekers end up, and who can you reach?
There could be a sight seekers in every town in England.
Yeah.
That would be fabulous, wouldn't it? Can you just imagine sight seekers like Hull or sight seekers... Well, Wigan, who yeah. knows, you know.
That's fantastic, thank you. So just tell us how we can get in touch with the group.
Yes, the Sight Seekers group meet at Galloway Society for the Blind in Chorley on the last Wednesday of every month between 1:30 and 3:30. So please come along.
And do you have a Facebook page?
We do, yes. It is Sight Seekers, all one word, and it... And we're very pleased about this at the moment because it's a new venture for us, but everything's going digitised, everyone, so we have to do it. We have to move with the times.
Great. Thank you, Lynn, and good luck with the group for the future.
Thank you.
Thanks, Danielle. And if there's something going on in your local area, then do get in touch with the RNIB Connect team. It's as simple as sending us an email. And you can do that through the weekly connects at rnib.org.uk, and we'll pass on your details. Finally, on the show this week, let's turn to our Society of the Week. Last week, we visited Wales. This time, we visit Scotland. And what could be more Scottish than playing golf?
My name is Barry Hampton. I was formerly a project manager with the NHS Tayside till I lost my sight in 2005, whereas I became a member of the Scottish Blind Golf Society and took up the sport for the first time. And Currently, I'm the treasurer for the society.
My name is Robin Claydon. I'm in Dunfermline. I've been involved with the society for over 25 years, and I'm currently on 10 years acting as their secretary. I've done a few other posts on the committee, but I'm 10 years been doing the secretarial work and organising the programme of events.
The Scottish Blind Golf Society is one of something like 11 societies internationally, and lads in the society last year, I think they played Austria, Japan, Canada, Ireland, you name it, you know, they're playing all over the world. And it's opportunities they would never have had had they just been an ordinary member of a golf club with sight.
The society was born about 1987 through in the west of the country, and it's just developed right throughout the country. At one point we had maybe nearly 60 members. We started off with just getting volunteers to help people out on the golf course, take them out socially and get, you know, swing a club, until it's developed into proper competitions, and we now play like a Ryder Cup style match against England every year, and we play a game against Ireland as well. So it's developed over the years and given people so many opportunities to, as Barry mentioned, to even travel the world and play in other countries. We do get a grant from the RNA to help us with our domestic programme, and people like Royal Blind, there's the primary club, the cricket charity, who actually help us as well, and various little trusts and rotary clubs. I first got involved, oh boy, about 1990, about 27 years ago. A lady that worked beside me, she kept telling me about this little group of people who played golf in Edinburgh, and they were all visually impaired, and that was when the Blind Golf Society was in its early days, and I had given up the game when I was young because of my failing eyesight, and I never really believed I would get a kick out of it again, but eventually I went along and I met this group of people, and well, the rest is history, as I say. It's been really good.
I joined in 2006. Anne Williams, the worker for the Fife Institute for the Blind, gave me the details and recommended me to join that, you know, to foster my career in the golfing world. Since I started, I had no golfing experience at all, and I was fortunate in the sense that my son was able to guide for me, and although he had no golfing experience either. And basically, it was the social impact that we enjoyed playing golf without any real competitive issues regarding it. We met great people, all with different eyesight problems, and encouraged us. I joined the local club to meet Drumoig, and again, I was accepted there. I was the only member with a visual impairment, and they were a bit wary at first, but 10 years on, I've got to say that I'm holding my own with some of the lads in the club, and really enjoying it. It seems to be that members are very wary of the situation of a partially sighted member coming in. They don't know what to do with us. One of the problems, I think, is we're all labelled blind, when in fact we're not blind at all, we're visually impaired. We've all got different reasons for playing golf, and we've all got different ways that we can see the golf ball. Some can't see the ball at the feet, some can, you know, this sort of thing. We all require guides to help us, you know, to get around the golf course. And I think by personally trying to better ourselves, that gets through to the golfers that we're playing with. And from a kind of situation going back 10 years ago when they weren't sure what to do with us now, there's very much an interest. How are you getting on? Where are you playing next week? When did your tournament start? How are you doing in competitions? If you need a help, let me know. This sort of thing. So, locally, I think I've broken a barrier, you know, with the golfers, and I'm sure that anyone joining other clubs might go through the same aspect of that as well. But it's letting people know that we can achieve golf, even though we have a disability.
The society's been great for a lot of people. It gets you out and about, you're into the community, all this integration and inclusion buzzwords that you hear these days. And I mean, I've made dozens and dozens of friends over the years through the society, and not just here in Scotland, but, you know, all over the UK.
Technically, the guide is the name that we use for the assistance that we get. In my case, my son will stand behind me and direct me. Yeah, we get on quite well, usually for the first couple of holes. Then family loyalty kind of disappear a wee bit, but enjoy the social aspect of it. I did have a competitive spirit when I was younger, which I lost, and I've certainly regained that now. You know, so yes, there's an independence that comes from having joined the society and taking up a sport. You know, and I certainly want to prove myself, you know, in the eyes of the golfers that do watch us, you know, from golf clubs, etc. Although there may be no remark on it, but I think they're quite proud to have helped me, you know, get to where I am today.
I don't know what I'd do with my time. It certainly kept me busy over the years.
It's the loss of my eyesight that actually they found I had lung cancer. And so it was a kind of double whammy going back in time to 2005, 2006. So I was kind of coping with one, then coping with the other. But I've got to say I'm 200% happy with the treatment I got from the NHS and how they looked after me. I was still young at the time, 57-ish. So I still had a life to go ahead and, you know, with myself. And I think, to be honest, through my work, the project management type things, I was used to looking into situations and trying to progress them, you know, to the best of it, and I just adapted that to myself.
You can find out information at all the societies for the blind around the countryside, Visibility Scotland, RNIB, yourselves. All these sort of outlets for visually impaired people have information. And, of course, we have our own website, which I look after at www.scottishblindgolf.com.
And that's it for the show this week. Many thanks for tuning in. If you have a topic you want to discuss, get in touch. It's your programme, The Weekly Connect at rnib.org.uk. Remember, if it's Mondays from 1, it's The Weekly Connect.